Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Cults and Extreme Fandom. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. 2024 really did turn out to be a very stressful year. An absolute shit show, you might say. With the world still recovering from a global pandemic, technology advancing at a breakneck pace, war in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, and another highly contentious election in the United States. Let's be honest, 2025 is likely to be more of the same. Our society feels more fractured than ever before in times like these, and it's not uncommon for us to grasp for meaning and safety in the face of uncertainty. That safety is often found in groups and ideologies that can go from enthusiastic fandoms to toxic groups at the drop of a hat. It's easy for people to lose themselves in these movements, to make them their whole identity and reason for living, to become nothing else and fully embrace what they join. It can take over their minds, control their thoughts and actions, drain their wallets and use them for their own ends. And these groups are on the rise, and not just in the United States, but all around the world. The official, I guess, scientific term for these groups is high control groups. But the term that often gets used the most, and likely what you and I call them in our everyday vernacular, are cults. Cults can take all types and forms, from religious to business-orientated self-improvement organizations and political movements. Chances are you know someone who's fallen under the spell of a charismatic leader, who they adore without question, whose word they trust above all else, and who is above the law in their eyes. It's far more common than you might think. It doesn't have to be a religious leader or public speaker. It might be a politician, celebrity, or other public figure. It can be really frustrating, even heartbreaking, to lose someone to a group such as these, and you can't help but feel helpless. You might fail to understand what they find so appealing about said charismatic leader or their group. It might seem really obvious to you that said group or leader is quote-unquote full of shit. You likely feel that there's just no way to reach out to this person, to snap them out or reason with them. Far too often, the easiest option is to just cut them off. They may cut you off long before you reach that point. Many families have been splintered over highly coercive groups, and yet snapping out of it can and does happen. People escape from these kinds of groups all the time. So how does it work? Where exactly is the discourse and realization? What is the mental process that causes people to fall into these groups in the first place? And more importantly, what is the mental process that causes them to break free from cult activity? I thought it would be good to put the judgment aside and just really look at what goes into the psychology of a cult. If you've lost a loved one to one of these groups, what it really takes to snap them back to reality. In fact, when I studied psychology at university, my dissertation was in this area. titled, quote, "The Effect of High Control Groups on Common Beliefs and Perceived Reality," unquote. I spent more than a year researching this topic, so I'm really happy that it didn't go to waste and I can share my findings with you all tonight. For this episode, we sifted through both my own research and the latest research in cult psychology. We also spoke to an expert in cult behavior and picked his brain on the work that he does to help with former cult members, supporting them to re-acclimate to society. So the question here is, how exactly do you deprogram a cult member? Well, before we get into the details, I should probably start by saying that despite what the title I have chosen says, and some of the terminology that I have used thus far, the word deprogram is a bit of an antiquated term. I'm trying to tread a thin line between using phrases that are understandable to the common man, but whilst also remaining current and medical. But first, let's quickly review a few of the worst cults in history, just for context. For the purpose of this episode, I'm defining worst just as the ones with the highest body counts. Other factors are of course interpretive. First up is the Heaven's Gate cult. Anybody that was around in 1997 probably has the images seared into their minds. Room after room full of bunk beds containing people in tracksuits and matching Nike shoes covered by a purple shroud. In March of that year, Earth was visited by the Hale-Bopp comet, which is one of the brightest and most spectacular comets that we'd seen in the last 50 years to that point. It made big news at the time. People all around the world were looking up in awe at the sky, but nobody more so than the Heaven's Gate cult. On March 26th, the 39 members of the group all went out to dinner at a local San Diego restaurant, and they all ordered the same thing. Turkey pot pie, cheesecake with blueberries and iced tea. They then went back to their Rancho Santa Fe compound, recorded goodbye messages into a video camera, changed into their tracksuits, and then consumed a mixture of barbiturates and vodka with applesauce. They each then went to their bunk beds and drifted off to sleep. Two remaining members then methodically went from room to room with a plastic bag, putting it over each person's head until they asphyxiated. And then they took their own lives by taking a lethal dose of barbiturates themselves. They each believed that by doing so, they would ascend up into a UFO that was hiding behind the comet. So how did nearly 40 people come to that conclusion? How do 40 people believe it so strongly that they're willing to end their lives for it? Well, it didn't happen overnight. It took around 25 years, in fact. The leader was a man named Marshall Applewhite. He grew up in Texas and studied music, later becoming a music professor and choir master at the University of Alabama. Following a divorce, in 1968 he endured a nervous breakdown and eventually wound up in a psychiatric hospital in 1972, where he met a nurse named Bonnie Lou Nettles. The two immediately formed a bond and became soulmates, though their relationship was not physical. They came to the conclusion that they were advanced super beings prophesied in the Book of Revelation. They both began traveling the United States, spreading their word and developing an intricate belief system where they believed that they were what they called, quote, "a level above human, heaven in human form," unquote. They saw it as their duty to convert as many people as possible to their belief system, to be just like them. Marshall and Bonnie Lou believed that the human body was just a vessel, and that in order to ascend to a higher form, they had to discard all human interests and all human desires. They also believed that aliens were a pure spiritual form, and that someday a spacecraft would come and take them away to a higher plane. Sometimes, with stuff like this, you really have to question whether they truly believed what they preached. But Marshall and Bonnie Lou genuinely believed all of this. They changed their names to Bo and Peep, essentially because they thought of themselves as religious shepherds. But later on, they would change their names again to Doe and T. Some of Marshall's acquaintances stated that Bonnie Lou had a significant influence over him. Bonnie Lou, it is believed, was responsible for reinforcing Marshall's emergent delusions. Over the next decade, they recruited people into their group, eventually reaching around 200 members, before they started to weed out all but the most loyal and obedient of the group. Members were kept to a strict code of uniformity. There was no smoking, alcohol, or sex allowed, and they all wore the same baggy clothes and androgynous haircuts. They wanted to be genderless. In fact, some of the men in the group submitted to castration, including Marshall himself. They each performed regimented work to busy themselves and maintain funding for their group. Bonnie Lou sadly died in 1985, leaving Marshall to control the group all alone. By the 1990s, they had settled in a large compound in San Diego and founded a successful web design company called Higher Source. In 1995, when the Hale-Bopp comet was discovered, Marshall decided this was the sign that they had been waiting for. The group took their own lives for their beliefs, but as far as cults go, they were fairly innocuous. They weren't a great threat to anyone other than themselves. People were also free to leave the group at any time, and various members did over the years. I'm not suggesting this group was a positive factor on its members' lives, but it certainly could have been worse. Which brings me on to my next group of people. The Branch Davidians. I've actually produced an episode about these folks, titled Waco, David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. It's episode number 38 from March 2023, if you'd like to go back and give it a listen. It's a more in-depth and detailed dive than tonight's episode. The Branch Davidians are pretty controversial, because depending on who you ask, they're either a crazed, extremist, child-abusing, apocalyptic cult that killed five law enforcement officers and then burned themselves in a fire, or they're a religious sect that was murdered in cold blood by federal agents. There are actually some people out there who make the argument that they shouldn't really even be called a cult, though I completely disagree with that one. The Branch Davidians are a modern religious movement. They split from the Seventh-day Adventists in the 1930s, and the Davidians were formed by a Bulgarian immigrant named Viktor Hotev. Hotev believed that Jesus was not the Messiah prophesied in the book of Isaiah, and that the Messiah had yet to actually come. When the Messiah would actually arrive, it would bring about the end times. And of course, this was going to happen any day now. So Hotev and the Davidians bought land outside of Waco in Texas and named it Mount Carmel. They built a huge sprawling compound which housed all of their members. Hotev's death in 1955 split the group a little bit, with some following Hotev's widow Florence and others following a pastor named Benjamin Roden. Florence and her followers eventually left Mount Carmel, and the remaining members took up the name Branch Davidians. By 1981, Benjamin Roden had passed away, and the leadership of the group passed on to his wife Lois and also his son George Roden. Then came along Vernon Wayne Howell. Howell had a troubled and shaky past, but he had just become a born-again Christian, bouncing from the Southern Baptist Church to the Seventh-day Adventists. He eventually ended up at Mount Carmel. Howell's rise to leadership of the group wasn't so straightforward. Sure, he quickly won over supporters with his detailed and encyclopedic knowledge of the Bible, but what really helped him rise to the leadership was his affair with Lois Roden. Howell genuinely believed that God told him that they were going to have a child together, and that that child would be the chosen one, the Messiah. George Roden didn't particularly like his mother getting involved with Howell, so he filed a lawsuit claiming that Howell had brainwashed and raped her. A power struggle broke out between Howell and Roden, but in 1987, George decided to put an end to the feud and challenge Vernon to a competition. Whoever won this competition would win leadership of the group. The competition was to ascertain who could raise the most people from the dead. George was up first, and he set about praying over the body of a deceased church member named Anna Hughes. Howell shrewdly used this to his advantage and decided not to participate. He instead called the police and reported George for corpse abuse. In November 1987, Howell eventually took control of the group by force and stormed the compound with seven of his followers, all heavily armed. Whilst George Roden survived, he had been shot multiple times in the conflict. Howell's attempted murder charge ended up in a mistrial. Howell now changed his name to David Koresh. Over the next 6 years, Koresh continued growing the church and preaching the gospel that he was the true Messiah, that had been prophesied all those years ago, and that the apocalypse was soon at hand. He claimed that children of the Messiah were sacred, and so therefore it was his duty to seed the world with his children in order to usher in his new kingdom. He ordered many of the women in the group to become his wives and have children with him, some of whom were underage and children themselves. 13 children would be born to Koresh and his many wives. But it wasn't the polygamy and underage sex that got the attention of the authorities. It was the stockpile of weapons that the group had been hoarding. Weapons in order to prepare for the upcoming apocalypse. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms took an interest in this, but that only validated Koresh's belief that dark forces were descending upon them. On February 28, 1993, agents from the ATF and the Texas Rangers rolled up on Mount Carmel to execute a search warrant. What happened next has been argued and debated ever since, but resulted in a massive gunfight that killed five of the agents, six of the Branch Davidians, and wounded 16 others, including David Koresh. It began a standoff between the two groups that would last for 51 days. The FBI grew in force, eventually becoming the largest military force ever gathered against a civilian suspect in American history. The FBI attempted negotiations to get them to come out of the compound, but it proved fruitless. And on April 19th, the FBI raided the compound with armored tanks and tear gas. A fire broke out and quickly engulfed the entire compound, killing 76 of the 85 people inside. There are still Branch Davidians around today, some of whom are still waiting for David Koresh to return from the grave. While researching my episode on Waco, I spoke over a few months with a survivor of the Waco siege, a Branch Davidian who still has strong religious beliefs. I'm unable to refer to him by name. Unfortunately, our relationship soured after I refused to read several volumes of religious literature that he had written. Over 3,000 pages to be exact. But one thing he made clear while we were speaking was that he remains a devout follower of David Koresh and indeed believed with his entire soul that Koresh was the Messiah. A brief shout out at this point to the Manson family who murdered seven people in an attempt to start a race war. Check out our episodes 20 and 21 for our series on them. It's a subject that I've been fascinated with for many years. But I can't talk about cults without mentioning the People's Temple Agricultural Project, also known as Jonestown. Their leader, Jim Jones, had become known as the gold standard of cults after nearly 1,000 of their members killed themselves by drinking cyanide-laced Flavor Aid in 1978. Jim Jones grew up as a poor kid in Indiana to an alcoholic father. Due to childhood abuse, he seemed to turn inwards and become obsessed with religion and death. Friends would later tell stories of him holding funerals for dead animals that he had found. He joined the Pentecostal church and cut his teeth on the revival circuit, traveling from town to town, putting on shows to convert the masses. Standard religious fare. Having grown up poor, he felt connected to disadvantaged communities and filled his pews with minorities. He adopted children of multiple races and got heavily involved in the civil rights movement at the time. Eventually, he picked up his following and moved them to California. He chose to settle in the town of Ukiah because he had read somewhere that it was one of the safest places to be in the event of a nuclear holocaust, which was something that he thought was coming soon. Here he established a farm where the entire congregation lived and worked. It was sort of a prototype for what would follow later on. And this is where he started leaning towards the ideas of communism. Of course, being the United States, this wasn't something that he could just come out and say to his followers. He had to preach it in terms of religion. People involved in the group had to hand over their money and possessions to him. He convinced older members of the group to sell their homes and give the money to the church. And then the church would put them up in senior citizen centers and take care of them. The congregation grew into the thousands. Jones preached against sex, calling it selfish and against the ways of God. Although he himself did not abstain from sex, of course, he slept with many of the congregation, including the men. In 1974, he moved the group to San Francisco and became politically active. He became a go-to guy in San Francisco politics. Politicians made a point of meeting with him, and he had a very positive reputation. Jones was named the head of the Housing Committee in San Francisco, and this seems to be when things started to spiral downward for him. Now that he was part of the government, he was under more scrutiny, and it didn't help that he had his members of the church join all of the council meetings and cheer wildly whenever he said anything. It made people start to wonder what was going on with this guy and his weird followers. The extra scrutiny made him more paranoid. He became convinced that progressives like him were being targeted, so he created his own secret service within the group that not only was there for his protection, but was also there to weed out dissenters from the group. His sermons got darker and more apocalyptic. At this time, anybody who stepped out of line was publicly shamed in church services. He even encouraged violence against dissenters, basically having beatdowns as part of the church service. He began to do drugs, which only amped up his paranoia. He was convinced the group wasn't safe anymore. So Jones bought up land in Guyana in 1975 and began constructing Jonestown, a jungle paradise where they would establish a communist utopia away from all the dark forces within the US government. Toward the end of July in 1977, Jones got word that some former cult members were speaking out against him and had been talking to a reporter from a magazine called New West. The magazine was set to publish a damning exposé filled with stories of fake faith healings, violence and sexual abuse. Within hours, Jones was on a plane to his settlement in Guyana. He moved the congregation to Jonestown almost overnight, and thus his stranglehold over them only tightened. They had no communication with the outside world, were made to work 18 hours a day, and he turned church members against each other. Jones had loudspeakers set up throughout the compound where he played recorded sermons and messages 24 hours a day, claiming that the outside world was falling apart and that their only salvation was at Jonestown. No matter where they were, Jones's voice was always in their ear. Over time, the messages got darker and more apocalyptic, more convinced that dark forces were bearing down on Jonestown. Then, in November 1978, Jonestown was visited by Congressman Leo Ryan of California. He had a reputation as a hands-on politician who wanted to make positive change. On November 17, 1978, he flew down to Guyana with some members of his staff and a handful of reporters, and initially they were impressed with what they found when they first got there. Ryan had heard all kinds of stories from ex-cult members and from within the press, and he was concerned about what was going on in Jonestown. Initially, he thought, he couldn't have been more wrong. The congregation welcomed them with open arms. They held a reception with music, food and dancing, and they couldn't stop telling the visitors how happy they all were to be there. But later in the evening, some cracks began to show. That night, a couple of people slipped notes to the camera crew that were accompanying Ryan, asking for help escaping Jonestown. The next morning, Leo Ryan confronted Jim Jones about it, with Jones stating that these people were liars who only wanted to bring down all the good that he had created at Jonestown. As Ryan and his group prepared to leave, more and more people came out of the woodwork begging to go back with them. Then all hell broke loose. 16 Jonestown residents joined the congressional delegation, and they left Jonestown for the nearby airport. But as they were boarding a plane, another truck pulled up, and several gunmen jumped out and opened fire upon them. 5 people were killed on the airstrip, including Congressman Ryan. Back at the compound, Jones called an emergency meeting in the pavilion, where he broke the news of the congressman's death. Seeing no way out, he ordered his underlings to mix up some cyanide with Flavor Aid, not Kool-Aid, and began distributing it throughout the congregation. This is where the term drink the Kool-Aid came from. They gave it to the children first, in order to give the parents less reason to go on living. Families were told to lie down together in the grass outside the pavilion, and in a matter of hours, it was all over. 909 men, women and children lay dead. Jones was found lying on the pulpit with a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. 36 people who were at Jonestown survived the massacre. Some of them hid. Some of them fled into the woods. One person slept through the whole thing. Many of the survivors of Jonestown don't like calling it a mass suicide. They said that people with guns surrounded the pavilion, pointing them inwards, and forced people to drink at gunpoint. And even those who did drink willingly had been psychologically stripped of their agency in the preceding years. To the survivors, this was a mass murder, without a shadow of a doubt. It's interesting and entirely tragic how people come to get caught up in cults, how they get recruited or fall victim to them. Cults tend to thrive when there are difficult times, and with what that has been going on in the world over the last few years, we may be entering a new golden age of cults, to say the very least. We are in the midst of a generation-defining era that has completely upended social norms. In fact, I asked a cult expert, Dr. Jasper Lovell of Cornell University. I asked him if he felt that statement was accurate.
Yes, absolutely. Because when societies are in turmoil, the cults can do very well because people are at a loss. Or they may be looking for a framework to understand what the hell is going on. So as time has gone on, it's starting to really feel more and more like that's where we are, unfortunately.
I'm going to take a look at the psychology of people within cults. How their beliefs tend to continue to be reinforced, how they push back against any evidence that contradicts their beliefs, and what techniques or messages finally get through to them. So let's talk about a defining quality that cults have and what we mean when we use that throwaway word. It gets tossed around a lot. Anybody who thinks differently than themselves is in a cult, it seems. But what's the difference between a cult and just extreme fandom? For example, are Taylor Swift fans, Beyoncé or Harry Styles fans members of a cult? Those fans do have a figurehead whom they follow, either in person or through the media. They have their own clothing styles. They give money to the movement in the form of album sales and concert tickets. They gather for celebrations or gigs, and they pretty much push back at any criticism of their leader. Yes, there are absolutely parallels between being in a cult and being part of an extreme fan group. But there are nuanced differences, namely, how we want to be seen, how we want to receive identity and acceptance, how we want others to accept who and what we are, to love us unconditionally, and to forgive us when we mess up. Whilst both cults and extreme fandoms offer a sense of community, the difference is, with fandoms, the person you look up to is somebody who gives you tools to be your best self. With a cult, it's more about exploitation, where the leader exploits the follower's personality for their own benefit. With fandoms, the follower is the person to receive quick reward for limited input. Buy a ticket, attend a concert, buy an album, download the music, and so on. It's called a direct transaction relationship. With a cult, it's the leader who receives the reward. The follower hardly ever and sometimes never benefits. They follow the words of the leader unequivocally. The leader gains power, control, and sometimes gains financially. The follower pays out, does the work, gives up freedoms, family members and so on. Cult members perceive themselves to be gaining when in actual fact they rarely, if ever, are, though they are led to believe that they are in almost every single case. If you lead a group or are the subject of fandom, what you have to ask yourself is whether you are exploiting an experience, or if you are creating a shared experience. It's a very fine line, although the line is entirely there. The parasocial element of the relationship in which a follower is engaged is also a key factor. Parasocial relationships are essentially one-sided relationships where one person extends emotional energy, interest, and time, and the other party, the persona, is completely unaware of the other's existence. This is how fandom works. Although there are exceptions where some fans take their obsession to the next level and try to insert themselves into the lives of the person they follow. Although this doesn't make the relationship any less of a fandom, it just adds element of obsession to the mix. Now, to understand how an individual can exploit another person, you have to think a little bit about how the mind works. It's entirely psychological. You also need to understand what a cult is, how they recruit members, and the ways that they manipulate those members. You see, no one volunteers to join a cult. Instead, they are recruited into a cult, and there is almost always never any informed consent. Everyone has vulnerabilities, everyone, even the most hardened of individuals. Possible situational vulnerabilities can include illness, the death of a loved one, the breakup of an important relationship, the loss of a job, or moving to another city, state, or country. Once somebody is in a vulnerable state, they can fall victim to a number of recruitment strategies. Things like a person at work or a friend recruiting somebody, or being recruited through social media, YouTube videos, or podcasts. Now, I have to add that as someone with a mental health and psychology background, the best way to understand mind control is to know that it's a dissociative disorder. And what I mean by that is, it's a disruption of your self or identity. So with that in mind, how does somebody get to a place where they're influenced into actually wanting a new identity? Well, Rachel Bernstein is a therapist who specializes in treating cult survivors. And according to her, people who end up joining cults are never really given the full story about the group in advance of joining. Thus, they end up making a judgment based on selected and proportioned information that the cult shares with them. But there are some common things that draw people to cults. One, they often want to better themselves, personally or professionally. And two, they desire a sense of community. I briefly spoke to Bernstein, and she told me what draws people in.
Sometimes people are just wanting to connect with people they think they have something in common with. And a cult provides instant community and love bombing and a language that suddenly you all speak.
The third thing is that people who end up joining cults are usually in extremely vulnerable positions. These people may have recently lost a job or a loved one, or they may be experiencing an illness, or that something tragic may have happened to them. There is a common misconception that those who fall victim to cults are weak-minded or easily manipulated, but this is not true. Cults take advantage of the timing of an individual's vulnerability to recruit new members. In 2017, 31 former cult members were interviewed as part of a research project which was published in Psychiatry Research, a professional psychology periodical. The aim of the project was to understand what contributed to them joining a cult. What they discovered was that former members reported being dissatisfied with life, that they wanted personal development and spirituality. They felt lost. These were the main factors that they all identified. There was also the issue of access, as was written in the Outcome Project statement. Cultic groups were present in the members' environment before their commitment to the group, be that in their neighborhood, workplace, or through social association. There was evidence of a slow build of influence over time throughout a negative life moment. 32.2% reported a social presence of the group in their family or social circle, where 19.4% reported having family members already within the group. When asked what influenced them to stay in the cult, former members spoke of an inability to question the creeds or legitimacy of the group, having regressive and reassuring feelings resulting from being part of the group, and of being in a relationship with other cult members or with the cult leader. Also, if the members had lost support of their family or friends, they usually felt helpless and found it hard to resume the life that they had before joining the cult. But if they did end up leaving, there were a few reasons why. Reasons like loss of faith in the cult's message, beliefs, or imperfections or contradictions in the cult leader. Internal group conflict and a higher chance of leaving increased with one specific factor: family. The possibility of departure is greater when one's family keeps in touch with a member in the context of mutual understanding while avoiding criticism. But once a person has left a cult, then what support is there for the person? What can be done to help them get back into their former life, emotionally, socially, and mentally? In other words, can you deprogram someone who joined a cult? Can you remove or undo any quote-unquote brainwashing that the former cult member has undergone? Well, maybe, and it depends on how it's done. Some researchers think that ex-cult members will gravitate back to the ideas they already believed in on their own and without intervention. While these people are doing things of their own volition, family and friends may believe that they're being brainwashed. In Montreal, Canada, there is an organization that was founded in 1980 called the Center for Assistance and for the Study of Cultic Phenomena, or infosect.org. This organization believes and reinforces the idea that deprogramming methods on former cult members actually has a negative impact on the ex-cult member, so no longer use that methodology. Using terms like brainwashing or mind control tend to imply some magical kind of process that goes on or happens in people who are unaware of what's happening to them, the organization told Popular Science in 2021. Though they do understand that using terms like brainwashing is a simple message that gets people's attention. In the 1970s, it became popular to try to counteract brainwashing with counter-brainwashing. And that thinking emerged when a man named Ted Patrick thought that the Children of God group was brainwashing his family members. Patrick believed that since cults were using indoctrination tactics like hypnosis and repetition, he could reverse them with his own deprogramming. Cult members would be physically held or abducted and put in a secret location or detained while at home. It was part of an extreme intervention type practice and controversial in itself. They would then be held for several days or weeks while a deprogrammer fed them information until they finally submitted to the mind control methods. This was successful for literally thousands of people, but it also failed on many occasions. Exit counselling became the preferred method in the 1980s. This approach is entirely legal and non-coercive. Free will is respected, and it's 100% voluntary. A lot of this obviously depends on what exactly their personalities are too, of course. I've talked about how the conditions within the individual's environment can prime targeted people to be more vulnerable for cults. But what about their deeper personalities? Well, in 1995, researchers published the findings of a study in Personality and Individual Differences, another professional psychology periodical. They sampled 75 former cult members as part of their study. They had them take two personality inventories, essentially a short form of the Hans-Eisenick Personality Questionnaire and the Beck Sociotropy Autonomy Scale. I won't go into too much details regarding those tests, but you can look them up on Google to ascertain for yourselves what are asked as part of the questioning for them. The study found, when compared to norms, that ex-members showed elevated marks of neuroticism, sociotropy, and autonomy. But their neuroticism scores approached the norm the longer that they had been out of the cult. Additionally, ex-cult members showed reduced neuroticism and sociotropy levels when they were in contact with support groups compared to those who were not. Now, while it's not possible to draw firm conclusions from a study of this design, the results are consistent with the view that people with high autonomy scores are likely to have or be rejected from cults or new religious movements, and that by doing so may cause psychological difficulties which are ameliorated by time and attendance at a support group. So with all that in mind, how exactly do you get someone out of a cult? Kidnapping a person and forcing them to stay somewhere against their will is no longer the preferred method, and also, well, illegal. But, in essence, you should do your best to try and stay in contact with the person who has joined the cult. But this isn't always easy and can be a battle. But if you can get one-on-one time with a person, or, even better, obtain the opportunity to ask questions without external interference or contribution, then you will have the opportunity to offer anti-cult evidence. You can, in a subtle manner, challenge the cult's thinking, theories or beliefs. Maybe even work with another friend or family member to play good cop, bad cop. Have another person deliberately approach the situation haphazardly so that your support seems to be more positive and a better direction to lean in. It's all about showing that the cult member has a safe and non-judgmental place to come home to. Keep conversations positive, adopt a curious tone about a cult member's beliefs, and don't tell them anything or demand anything. Don't use ultimatums. Let them discover things of their own volition and free will. It's a journey and a slow burn. You have to be patient and try not to get discouraged, which can be difficult. The reason people join cults is because they feel like they're part of a community, remember? They've been love-bombed. That's what draws them into the cult in the first place. So criticizing them and yelling at them is not the thing that's going to get them to move away from the cult. The opposite will be the outcome, in fact. You have to let them know that they're safe with you, that they have other options, support and community. This is of course different from deprogramming, which doesn't really address any of the prior issues that they had in the first place, which caused them to join the cult. And it kind of connects them with a feeling that would prevent them from joining the cult again post-membership. Deprogramming also doesn't really deal with any family member, counselling, mental health issues or preparing cult members for follow-up care and support. Being in a cult can take a drastic toll on somebody's mental state. It can detach them from reality. So, if you've got somebody that has now gotten out of a cult, that's a loved one of yours, how do you help them recover from that cult trauma? Well, it's best to understand what kind of ex-cult member you're dealing with. As I briefly touched on earlier, my interactions with an ex-Branch Davidian and Waco survivor provided me with an eye-opening understanding of former cult members. You should identify if they are someone who experienced an intervention, or did they walk away of their own free will? Or maybe they were expelled from the cult. This is rare, but it does happen. Those who walk away from a cult or were expelled will actually need the most help with recovery, psychologically speaking. They often feel angry, tricked, conned, and guilty or inadequate. The best tool for recovering ex-cult members is to understand what mind control is and how their specific cult used it on them. There is the reality too that the cult themselves often don't perceive themselves as cults. They don't understand what they are doing as being coercive or controlling, so there is often pushback, challenge and influence from that angle. But mind control effects don't last forever. When former cult members learn about mind control, they can use that understanding to sort through their cultic experience, to see how they came to change their behaviours and their beliefs as a result of mind control. They can then assess what out of that experience was good and valid for them to hold on to. This can turn their negative into a positive and make readjusting easier and feel less impactful. For some ex-cult members, all they have left is their family. Their friends in the majority of situations will have abandoned them a long time ago. Often the cult influences the members to cut off former friends and family members. This is common practice within the Church of Scientology, for example. Scientology considers non-members of the church suppressive people and a negative influence on its members, irrespective of their past relationship to the church member. There is currently a loneliness epidemic happening around the world. Almost half of United States adults say they experience measurable levels of loneliness. It's 43% of Brits and 51% of Australians. The number is higher for people aged 15 to 24, with 70% saying that they have little to no social interaction with their friends. Loneliness can lead to all kinds of health issues. Not just mental health issues, but physical too. Heart disease, strokes, dementia, and muscle pain all have scientific evidence to support that they are physical conditions that can be caused by high levels of loneliness. Mental disorders such as depression, anxiety, and stress are also triggered by it, which in turn then leads to the physical conditions. Like I spoke about earlier, cult members crave a sense of community and involvement. So it's no surprise that many people join cults who may be suffering from loneliness. And with loneliness at an all-time high currently, this leaves an open playing field for the formation of cults and for individuals falling victim to their recruitment methods. 2024 has been a very difficult year, and the cold, harsh reality is that 2025 will be more of the same. It's bleak to think about where we are as a society, as countries, and as a world populace right now. So many lessons from history have been ignored, and if you allow it in, the black dog can influence you far beyond a healthy mindset and psychological place. It's really important to prevent yourself from getting too indoctrinated into any ideology, and to prevent undue influence. It sounds obvious and easy, but we all need to ensure that there's some variety in our information sources. Social media algorithms and the fracturing of our media landscape is having a negative influence on a large proportion of us right now. Social media algorithms ensure that we only hear information in a sort of wind tunnel. It funnels like-minded people into your field of societal and cultural vision and blocks opposing views. This strengthens ideologies, good or bad. It weaponizes thoughts and theories instead of encouraging healthy debate. It breeds extremism across the entire political spectrum, left or right, and everything in between. We are kind of allowing ourselves to be brainwashed by just hearing the same thing every day. This causes a lot of us to take dissenting viewpoints as an attack on us personally. But it doesn't have to be that way. Our viewpoints and opinions don't have to all have an emotional impact or connection. Personally, for major news stories, I try and read the story from a few media sources with opposing political leanings and viewpoints. Often the truth is somewhere in the jumble of viewpoints and you can pull out the facts and form your own judgment. I think that's the best we can do at the moment. At the start of this episode, I covered a few cults. There is one in particular that I didn't mention that you may have thought, hold on, how could you not? Well, that's because we are working on a deep dive episode about those guys, and that should drop in the new year. Thank you for listening tonight, guys. If you haven't already, please check out and join our Patreon. It costs just $2 a month, which is insanely cheap and great value for money. You get additional episodes that we only upload to Patreon, and we also will be adding articles and research that we have conducted there too. So you get all that for less than a price of a cup of coffee. A hell of a bargain. Speaking of which, our next Patreon episode drops tomorrow too, so keep an eye out for that one. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.